Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
But let me start with this statement. Again, middle of November on a Monday, the Miami Dolphins are good. The Miami Dolphins are really good. I'm sitting smack dab in the middle of Southern California, and I'm starting a Monday program in the middle of November with a take on Miami. The Dolphins have won 5 in a row. They've won 6 of 7. The defense is no joke. Tua is doing exactly what they need him to do, and they've got guys doing this as well.
Long the punter. He's had one block this year. Kareem Grant, the return man, he's brought one back for a touchdown this year. Dropped it and blocked. It's on the ground. And the Dolphins are going to have the football deep inside their territory. Andrew Van Ginkel blocked it.
And boy, it is blocked clean. Another big play by special teams.
Man, they're the epitome of playing in all three phases. I mean, it's so beaten down and so cliche, right? But it's so true as it relates to Miami. And then you have Tua. Not only is Tua no joke, he just outplayed Justin Herbert yesterday. And yes, I know it was only one game. But for all those dopes doubting Miami for taking Tua, how do you feel about chasing that Crow Sando with a nice serving of humble pie a la mode for dessert? Again, I love Herbert. But Tua has got star written all over him. He's 3-0. They have ripped 5 in a row. And Brian Flores is the best of the Hood's dying coaching tree. Because the Dolphins matter. They matter a hell of a lot. And they matter a hell of a lot way earlier than anybody thought that they would. Great story. Had to give him some love off the very top on a Monday in the middle of November. Unfortunately, I've got to chase that good news with some bad news, because you know it's bad news when Drew Brees is taking himself out of a game. He never does that, but he did it yesterday against the Niners. And you know it's even worse news when he's not guaranteeing that he'll be out there for week 11, and he's saying it so early in the week. Not only is he not guaranteeing that he'll be out there for week 11, but he's saying things like this.
I'm just taking one day at a time. I've done that this entire season. And I'll continue to do that. I'm not sure what tomorrow holds, but you can know I'm going to do everything I can to be as effective as I possibly can come next week. No, I mean, nothing's a long-term thing. It's just a matter of, you know, how long it's going to be. And honestly, I really don't know. It's not something quite to this extent that I've experienced.
Yeah, that does not sound good. That does not sound good, and it certainly did not look good when he took this shot from Kentavious Street in the first half.
That's why they play so hard for him.
Pocket collapsing on Drew Brees, and he gets drilled by Kentavious Street. There is a flag throw.
Drew Brees right there, you can tell that one hurt.
Yeah, it did. He tried to gut it out, but he could not go in the second half. Again, we're talking about a guy who has only missed 6 games in his 20-year career. 5 of them came last year when he shredded a thumb ligament. So when he's talking like that, it sure seems like Sean Payton's going to have to make a decision on Jameis Winston or Taysom Hill for Sunday, next Sunday. They've proven they can win without Brees, but they certainly, obviously, would rather not be in that position, even if Brees is not quite what he used to be. I mean, yes, it is a next man up league, unless the next man up is trying to fill the shoes of one of the best to ever do it. And so the question of, is it Jameis or Taysom? I don't know. I don't even think they're teammates. No. So now we wait on Brees and the MRI and the x-rays. Here is another question for you in the meantime. Has anybody seen the Baltimore Ravens? And what the hell happened to that team? Remember when they smashed the Browns to start the year and they look like a Super Bowl contender? Neither do I. They've lost 2 of 3. They look nothing like themselves. I mean, I get that last night's game in New England looked like it was played inside of a car wash, but shouldn't bad weather help Baltimore? Aren't the Ravens built for the elements? Like, if you made me pick which team would be better off in a typhoon, I would have said the Ravens, and I would have been wrong. And that does not happen very often. I mean, not to be arrogant, but I'm not sure that's ever happened. And yes, I know they're banged up, but this is more than that. Like, their mojo is gone, and so is their swagger. Losing to KC in Pittsburgh is one thing, but getting worked by this Patriots team is entirely another. Lamar does not look like himself. He's been talking about defenses calling out their plays, and then after last night's game, he was just pissed.
We ticked off. You know, don't nobody like losing, especially when we know we got a lot of talent on our team. You just got to regroup.
You do have to regroup. They better regroup. Stat. Because right now they're sitting in the final playoff spot in the AFC, and they're not showing any signs at all of coming out of this free fall. They're already three games back of the Steelers because the Steelers are still undefeated. Ben Roethlisberger didn't practice last week due to COVID protocols, and it didn't even matter. He had his best game of the year, 333 yards, four touchdowns, including two, to Chase Claypool.
Pumps once, fires over the middle. Chase Claypool with a leaping grab in traffic for the Steelers' 11-yard touchdown. How about that? Mapletron over the middle.
Yeah, I've said it before, I'll say it again right now. If you're an opposing defense, maybe you got to try to cover Chase Claypool. It'd be a pretty good idea. Then again, I'm not even sure it matters. Because even when you do cover this guy, he is still open.
Ben in the gun at the five. Blitz. Quick pop over the middle. Chase Claypool bucks his way into the end zone for his second touchdown of the game.
Oh, Mapletron got it.
We'll take it.
Yeah, we'll take it.
Nice catch by Chase.
Mapletron, if you need him. What? Canadian Baconatron didn't want any of that. Denimatron didn't want any of that. Mapletron. Wow. Mapletron. Anyway, one other thing about the Mapletron-led Steelers. They're 9-0 now. Has there ever been a more quiet 9-0 team in the history of the NFL? Like, if Tom Brady's Patriots were 9-0, or if Tom Brady's Bucks were 9-0, you would never hear the end of it. Same for KC. Same for Baltimore. Yet, Mapletron and the Steelers do it, and nobody even notices. Like, if Mapletron is out there in the middle of the forest, leading his team to a 9-0 start, does it even make a sound? As long as we're talking about big-name teams with good records, hey, Avi, do me a favor. Can you hit me with a bed? Work your magic, wizard. Yeah, only Alvy. Only Alvy can do that. You know what that means? You know where I'm going with that? Vegas, baby. Because the Las Vegas Raiders are 6-3. I'm still not used to saying Las Vegas Raiders. And I'm also not used to the Raiders looking like an actual football team. It's been a minute or two since that was the case. And yes, I know they only put a beating on the 3-6 Broncos. And that they didn't necessarily look that great in the first half. But I'll tell you what else they did. They beat the crap out of the Broncos in the second half. And that's what good teams do. They beat the crap out of bad teams. While Chunk Gruden might not be missing any meals, apparently he's not missing the opportunity to build a bully either. Because we know who will go. We know who will and who won't go, and the Raiders apparently will.
Yeah, it wasn't all supposed to be a Drew Lock throwing kind of offense. It was, oh, we got a fight going.
We do indeed. Joyner was covering KJ Hamler. Bodies have to be tossed aside, and they've got another one, another little fracas off to the side. So a couple here. Tim Patrick, and then there's the punch, and there's another punch. Johnson threw one, Patrick threw one.
But Abrams is the one that started it.
Now, look, I'm not quite ready to say that the Raiders are all the way back. But when they're punching their opponents in the face, metaphorically and literally, they're pretty close to being back. And then there is America's team, the Cleveland Browns, the team that all of America loves and one or two of you dopes hate. Yesterday, they took on the Houston Texans and Mother Nature, and they beat them both. Myles Garrett was doing what he does, and Nick Chubb was back to doing what he does, carrying for 126 yards on 19 carries, and that included this rip to ice the win.
Here's a toss. It's Chubb. He's strung out, and he's up the sideline in a big hurry.
Gone.
40, 30, breaking
allegedly.
3, 20, 10, 5, and he steps out of bounds at the one-yard line.
Clearly could have scored. Heads-up play so they can kneel down and get out of here with about 56 seconds left.
Fantasy alert, gambling alert, bad beat alert. If Alvy was on that, he would have been like, dude, he's at the 40, the 30, the 20, the 10, the 1. What the hell is he doing? He just went out of bounds. You know, that's a heady play. And I know that might have hurt some of you in fantasy or your other assorted endeavors. But that's what you're supposed to do in that situation. Nick Chubb did what Todd Gurley could not do earlier.
I got a call from, you know, the coach and from Baker to not score, you know, get the first down in the game. So that's what I did. And luckily the run was a little longer because I didn't think about it until the last 10 yards. So.
That was amazing. Clones, what do we want when we're craving protein or we need more energy? Not bars, not sugary snacks, not energy drinks. No, we want beef, pure and simple. So where's the beef? It's in a package of Old Trapper beef jerky. Old Trapper is not your old man's jerky. Shriveled, dry, tasteless. Old Trapper beef jerky is made from lean strips of steak and quality spices that are smoked over a real wood fire. It's tender, it's tasty, it's not tough. So what makes it so good? It's because Old Trapper is a 50-year-old family business known for their relentless commitment to quality. They take smoked beef extremely seriously, and you can taste it in every single bite. Old Trapper is packed with protein, and it comes in four amazing flavors to satisfy all your cravings. Quality smoked meat at its finest that goes with you wherever you go. Plus, it's in a clear view bag. That way you can see the quality that you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. Clones, if you don't see it, be sure to ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? He is host of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. He is a Westwood One and CBS Sports Network broadcaster. You can follow him at Ross Tucker NFL. He is a friend of the program. He appears courtesy of My Front Page Story. Ross, welcome back. What's up? How are you?
Jim, I'm fantastic. I always love coming on with you. And when you play Welcome to the Jungle, I mean, I'm ready to jump through the phone right now, man. I want to play tonight.
My man, I feel the same way about you, Ross. I always look forward to our conversations. Great to have you back. Thanks so much. Listen, you have seen plenty of Hail Marys in your time, both as a player and as a broadcaster. So where does that Kyler Murray to DeAndre Hopkins Hail Mary rank for you?
Oh, man. Well, certainly that was the game of the year in the NFL so far, and that was the play of the year in the NFL so far. And I guess right now, Jim, I can't think of one that's better. And I say that because usually Hail Marys that end up being converted, it's luck, right? Like, I mean, the ball bounces or gets tipped, or maybe it's a terrible job by one of the defensive backs and they try to pick it off or they don't bat it away. Nothing about that was luck, Jim. I mean, that was Kyler Murray somehow rolling to his left off his back foot, able to throw the ball 55 yards in the air. He only had one receiver who was even in the end zone. It's DeAndre Hopkins. He puts the ball perfectly right where he needed it to be. Hopkins has three guys around him, including Tre'Davious White. They all jumped as high as they could. They all timed it up pretty well. Like, I don't even know what to tell those guys. DeAndre Hopkins was just a little bit taller, a little bit longer arms. He could jump a little bit higher. What makes this one the best I can think of right now is that it was skill. It was a great player making a highly skilled play. Luck had nothing to do with that.
What a great description. Ross Tucker is joining us. And then, Ross, you tweeted yesterday, quote, Kyler Murray is mesmerizing. Never seen anyone like him, end quote. Not only do I agree with that statement, but I've been saying this for a while. To me, he is the single most electric player in that league. But I really want your take, Ross, on what makes him so different from everybody else who has played that position.
Yeah, I think he's just quicker and faster than we've ever seen at the position before. You know, we've seen Michael Vick, who was crazy fast. Lamar Jackson has wheels. Russell Wilson is sort of like a poor man's Kyler Murray from an athletic ability standpoint. Obviously, Russell Wilson's a better player. But the way he runs around, it looks like, Jim, that if it were recess or after school with your buddies, where you have that one fast kid that nobody can really lay a hand on and two-hand touch, that's what Kyler Murray looks like to me, but it's the NFL. I mean, it's crazy. You know, I'll give you a comparison, okay? I'm from outside of Philly, you know that. This is what it reminds me of. It's like Allen Iverson. When Allen Iverson was in the NBA, he was by far like the quickest, fastest guy out there, And it was just, like, stupid how much faster and quicker he seemed to be than everybody else in the NBA. That's Kyler Murray in the NFL. He's crazy quick, and I've never seen a guy make NFL players look as bad or as slow consistently as Kyler Murray. I know he probably doesn't run the fastest 40 time or fastest 100 meters or whatever, but on the field, he looks like the fastest guy out there.
Ross Tucker joining us. I think that's a great description, too. It looks to me, Ross, like the coach has got the coach's clicker, and everybody's in the dark room, and they're watching video, and he's speeding it up, and he's backing it up, and he's speeding it up, and he's backing it up, and it's like Kyler is at 10 times or 20 times the speed. I mean, the guy, he is so explosive and so fast. Now, you played with the Bills. You've got a connection to that team. So how brutal of a loss is that for Buffalo?
Well, brutal for them and brutal for me because, you know, that was the place I played the most and stayed the longest, so I have an affinity for them. So I tweeted, Jim, after the unbelievable throw by Josh Allen and catch by Stephon Diggs, I said, these are not your same old Bills. Get used to this. And I hashtag Bill because I have an affinity for them. And I got the freezing cold takes, old takes exposed experience. But, you know, it's still not the same old Bills, by the way. I know they lost that game, but they didn't choke. They didn't blow it. They didn't yak that game up. You know, they did what they had to do offensively at the end, and Allen and Diggs deserve a lot of credit. And then Murray and Hopkins made like a 1 in 100 play. Tip of the cap to them. The Bills are still the best team in the AFC East. They're still going to win the division, and it's still not the same old Bills.
Ross Tucker is joining us, good friend of the program, appearing courtesy of My Front Page Story. Ross, what did you make of Nick Chubb's decision to run out of bounds instead of scoring late against the Texans, and what went through your head as you saw that unfold?
Okay, so in the interest of full disclosure, Jim, I have a sports betting podcast called the Even Money Podcast, and I have a lot of listeners, and I do well on it, and I take it seriously, so I will tell you my exact emotions. I'm watching the play, Chubb, and I'm feeling good about it because I told everybody to take the Texans plus 3.5 points. That was my advice. Feeling pretty good about it. The Browns are just basically running the clock out. I see him bounce outside and nobody tackle him and he's running down the sideline and my emotions, Jim, were like, you've got to be kidding me. This is awful. And I was not expecting him to run out of bounds. When he ran out of bounds at the 1 yard line, I cannot tell you how good of a feeling that was. Look, we already love football for all the reasons we love it and the DeAndre Hopkins play and blah, blah, blah. But fantasy football and being able to bet on the games, it takes it to a whole other level. I mean, everybody was disparaging Nick Chubb for what he did. In my mind and for my Even Money podcast listeners, Nick Chubb is a gosh darn hero. Okay, Jim? That guy is a hero. And by the way, it was the right play for the Browns to make sure they sealed the game.
Ross, here's what I absolutely love about that play. I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying, man. That must have been the most amazing feeling ever for you to see that guy step out of bounds. But can you imagine if you didn't hit that thing early in the week? Maybe you did. Maybe you got -3, and then you get a push, and you're pissed, but it's a push. But what if you waited? What if you ended up -3.5 or maybe -4? What was the more intense feeling, your feeling of joy and ecstasy or the person who suffered that bad beat because Chubb was just so smart and so heady? What do you think that must have felt like?
Awful. In my experience, the bad beat and the loss is always worse than the win is positive.
For sure.
Like on a scale of 1 to 10, I felt like a 7 or an 8. If I had the Browns laying the points, that would have been a 10 on the negative scale. I think everybody, and by the way, that's not the way it should be. You should feel the same way about a win or a loss or a good win or a bad beat, but that's just not how we are as human beings. It's just not, it's not rational. And that, I mean, I know a lot of people that were really, really upset about it, and it killed them. And I don't feel bad for them at all because I had Houston plus 3.5.
There you go. Ross Tucker joining us on the program. That is really funny. All right, so Miami's won 5 straight. What has impressed you the most about the current run the Dolphins are on?
Probably Brian Flores, actually.
Right.
You know, I think Tua's done a nice job, but it's really been all 3 phases. I mean, their defense is awesome. That was by far Justin Herbert's worst game. Their special teams makes a play every week. And for them to be sitting here at 6-3, I mean, who makes a transition from Fitz to Tua to a rookie like that and wins 5 games in a row? I think Flores is the coach of the year. I'm not surprised. When I played with the Patriots, Jim, he was actually a scout. He was in the front office as a scout. So he's got the background in personnel. He's a terrific coach. I think Stefanski's done a nice job. I think Matt Rule's done a pretty good job. But I think right now it'd be hard to not give the Coach of the Year award to Flores. I don't think anybody expected this.
Ross Tucker is joining us for a few more moments. He is appearing courtesy of my front page story today. Ross, watching last night's game, you get Baltimore and New England, terrible weather. I understand that. But the Pats just flat out tough the Ravens. Is that a really good win for the Patriots or a really bad loss for the Ravens?
Well, it's both, but I think it's probably more a really good win for the Patriots. You know, after they had that 4-game losing streak and then even beating the Jets, you know, by sort of a miracle late in the game with that field goal, I think a lot of people thought this is a terrible New England team. I mean, Joe Flacco puts up 27. You need Cam Newton to play great just to beat the Jets by 3. For them to go out and do what they did, I mean, they won the battle at the line of scrimmage with the Ravens, and not many people do that. Not many people are able to do that. It was really impressive. Tip of the cap to Belichick and Cam Newton and them for getting that done, because I've been pretty critical of Belichick, Jim. He's weird this year, man. I mean, he never used to talk about anything. Now he's putting out salary cap excuses. He's saying leaving the Jets was one of the best parts of his career. You know, this week he's talking about, you know, his draft picks, and he's defending his success over the last 20 years. I mean, what happened to the guy that before, all he would ever say is, I'm focused on Baltimore. We're moving on to Baltimore. He's like a new guy this year. He's praised Cam Newton more in the last 2 months than he did Brady in like 20 years. I think the personality switch by Belichick is really kind of bizarre, but give him a ton of credit for that game plan and that victory last night.
I agree. Big win for them last night, and the guy's mumbled his way through every presser for the past 2 decades, and now all of a sudden the guy enunciates and speaks like he's Winston Churchill. 7 years in the NFL, NFL analyst, host of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast. I could go on and on. Remember, appearing courtesy of my front page story. Ross, great job. You killed it like you always do. Appreciate you, man. Thank you.
My pleasure, Jim. Thank you so much for having me, as always.
All right, so Sunday at the Masters is always going to produce moments. That's just how it is. And it doesn't matter if that Sunday is in April or November. You could have it any time of year. It is always going to deliver. And there were some moments yesterday, you know, like Tiger Woods doing that mini tin cup on 12 and finding the water off the tee, which I'll get to later, because that was a moment. That was a historic moment. Not the kind of history the big cat was looking to make, but make it he did. No one can rip that green jacket from him that he ripped last year. And no one can rip that 10 on 12 from him either. You know, like, he really did bounce his Escalade off a tree in the middle of the night. And he really did card a 10 on Sunday at the Masters. Both those things happened. But nothing anybody did yesterday really mattered that much, because nobody was going to run down Dustin Johnson. Because DJ was the one making legitimate history. He finished at 20 under, winning by 5, the lowest score in history, the lowest score to par in major championship history. The largest margin of victory at the Masters since Tiger back in 97. Is that any good? Let me put it to you another way. Cameron Smith goes 67-68, 69-69. The first guy in 84 years to have 4 rounds in the 60s at the Masters, and he still loses by 5 shots. That shows you how dominant Dustin Johnson was. And it really shouldn't be a surprise because there's never been a question about this guy's game. The only question has been about his head. His game was good enough to have him entering the final day of a major with the lead or a share of it over and over and over again. And then it would always go wrong. Not just wrong, but really wrong and really weird. You know, the Sunday 82 at Pebble, the collapse at Chambers Bay, the three putts at Shinnecock Hills. And let's not even get into the grounded club at Whistling Straits. Now, he put a lot of that rap to bed after winning the 2016 U.S. Open. But he completely buried it yesterday. But still, it would have been the most Dustin Johnson thing ever to win the Masters by the margin that he did and actually not know until the 72nd hole what the actual score was. It was somewhere on 18 that he turned to his caddy, his brother Austin, you know, his twin, and he said, quote, "Where do we stand? Where do we stand?" He's saying this on the 72nd hole of the Masters. I mean, that is so awesome in a way, and so Dustin Johnson, and so fitting, given that according to Bob Herrig, a few years back, another player on tour said, quote, "You ever hear that movie Dumb and Dumber?" And then pointed at Dustin and Austin, which is incredible. Yeah, even more so now. Looks like Lloyd Christmas and Harold Dunn just got themselves a green jacket and a moment like this on 18 at Augusta National.
20 under by Stenson at the open in 16. 20 under by Jason Day. And the 2020 Masters. The long-awaited Masters has a long-awaited champion in Dustin Johnson.
You know, the crazy thing is, guys on tour might jab Dustin for not being Albert Einstein. But they seem to do it kind of affectionately. Like, they like the guy a lot. It's part of what makes DJ DJ. I mean, so what if this guy jacks up his back, lifting a jet ski now and then, allegedly, or falls down the stairs, allegedly? I mean, that's part of who this guy is, allegedly. And clones, I've already seen what you've tried to do with the win. I don't need any reference to the booger sugar right about now. Keep that sugar out your booger or something like that. I mean, just stay on topic. Put some respect on it. Stay on the fact that this dude went absolute legend yesterday. Like dumb or mentally one of the strongest dudes out there. Yeah, I said it. He runs into some legitimate adversity on the front nine with bogeys on 4 and 5, cuts his lead to 1, but immediately resets himself and then bounces back with birdies on 6 and 8. Then he goes birdie, 13 through 15. So he turns that potential choke job on the front nine into a victory lap on the back nine on Sunday at Augusta. That is so hard to do, yet this guy does it like it's nothing at all. Because to him, it probably was nothing at all. Because he's either really dumb or really strong mentally. So I've got some guys out there looking to impress you with their knowledge. This guy's just out there swinging bats, knocking a ball in the hole better than anybody else alive. Now, is this going to be the guy to split the atom anytime soon? Probably not. But does he need to? Seriously, if your rap on Dustin Johnson is he's not the smartest dude on the planet, my response at this point would be, and? So what? Believe me, if we were all that stupid, the world would be a much better place. Seriously. Like Bryson, man, he's smart as hell. Dude's damn near a physicist. And how'd that work out for him? He finished 34th. If they add a math section to the Masters or a comparative lit essay to the U.S. Open, maybe I would worry about Dustin. But this is about trying to get the lowest number over 72 holes, and it's pretty simple. Not only did that approach work, it might be the best approach of all. Seems pretty enjoyable, actually. This was a guy playing Sunday in the Masters, living out a childhood dream, and just a few holes away, and the guy was feeling no pressure at all. In fact, I think the guy's out there just numb. I don't think the guy's feeling anything at all. And find me one athlete on the biggest stage who would not want that sense of calm. Dumb? It's actually brilliant. The best way to beat the pressure is not to know that there's pressure. That's genius, man. Zen mind, beginner's mind. If your head is empty, that means it's not full of distractions and things that can derail you. He's the number one player in the world, and he just broke numerous records at Augusta National. I don't need to know this dude's IQ because I already know his final 72-hole score. And for all the talk about shaft length and angles and science going to this tournament, it was won by the guy with maybe the simplest approach of all. As Rory McIlroy said last week, Johnson's approach is, quote, see ball, hit ball, see putt, hole putt, go to the next, end quote. So while everybody was talking about the absence of detailed green reading books, Johnson adjusted by keeping it as simple as possible by simply drawing a line on his ball. Quote, I started using the line on the ball so I know where I'm aiming. Instead of guessing where I'm aiming, it definitely helped, end quote. I'm telling you, man, that is the truth. And so is the fact that he may seem relaxed and he may maybe talks a little bit slower than the most or the rest, but it doesn't mean he doesn't want it. It doesn't mean he doesn't care. You saw how choked up this guy got when it was over. Don't say this guy doesn't care. He does. And then he had this to say about how hard it is to win a major. Quote, there's the first major, and then there's the second major. Quote, the first major is the hardest. Then I would say the second one is just as hard, end quote. Maybe so, but I'm guessing the third will not be. Just as I'm guessing, there will be another. And probably more than that, because the guy is just that good. And maybe he is that dumb. But who says that's a bad thing? We should all be that dumb. You got to tip your hat. Guy was unbelievable. Did you know that a fire department responds to a fire every 24 seconds? That's scary, but that's true. So we have teamed up with First Alert, the most trusted brand in fire safety, to help you prepare for the unexpected and to review some key safety tips. Smoke and carbon monoxide alarms can help provide an early warning in the event of a home emergency. Having enough First Alert smoke and carbon monoxide alarms is one of the very best things that you can do to protect your home and your family. What you want to do is install alarms on every single level and in every bedroom of your home. Once those alarms are installed, it's then important to maintain them by testing them with regularity. Remember, alarms do not last forever. They do have to be replaced at least every 10 years. And if you can't remember the last time you replaced yours, it's best to replace that unit completely. My recommendation? First Alert's combination smoke and carbon monoxide alarm with a 10-year sealed battery. The alarm provides 2-in-1 protection, and I don't have to worry about changing out that battery for a decade. Lastly, make sure you take time to discuss home safety with your family. Plan and practice an escape route, and remember to practice it at least twice a year so you are ready. And for more information on fire safety products, safety tips, and educational activities that you can do at home with your family, go to firstalert.com/fireprevention month. firstalert.com/fireprevention month. He is John Rothstein. Oh, man, John, what's going on? How are you?
Never better, Romy. Great to be with you.
Good to have you, John. Great to have you here. All right, so a lot going on. The NCAA, John, announced this morning that the tournament, NCAA tournament, will be held in one location and that they are in talks with the city of Indianapolis to host the entire 68-team event there. First of all, what is your initial reaction to that news?
Proactive planning is always better than reactive planning, Jim, and you have to tip your cap to Dan Gavitt and everybody at the NCAA for this. We know that we're in uncharted territory. We know that we're in a once-in-a-century type global pandemic. Now we're in a situation where we have a plan, and after just hanging up on a call with Dan Gavitt, he made it very, very clear that once a team heads to that area where the NCAA tournament is held, and the NCAA is endeavoring to lock up, according to Gavitt, the city of Indianapolis as that host city by January 1st. Once a team travels to that city, it will not be permitted to leave until that team is eliminated from the NCAA tournament.
John Rothstein is joining us. John, the tournament has been scheduled to start in Dayton on March 16th and the 17th. Do you still expect it to start at that time, or could you see it moving back at some point?
You know, one of the things that's interesting, Jim, is Dan Gavitt said that, you know, because of the different protocols that have to be in place in order to successfully pull off a tournament in a short period of time, the calendar may not be the same for March Madness as it normally is. It's an imperfect year. It's an imperfect season. But the bottom line is this, Jim, at the end of the day, and I know I might be the perennial optimist, we see so many people succumbing to the negativity that goes on in our world today because of obviously everything that is going on in our world today. But at a time like this, you have to look at the positive. Are there programs shut down in college basketball due to COVID-19? Absolutely. Did the Ivy League cancel winter sports last week due to COVID-19? Absolutely. But the facts are the facts. Over 90% of Division I programs as of today are up and running. And the facts are the facts. There's going to be setbacks. There's going to be cancellations. But we're having a college basketball season, and we're having an NCAA tournament. If that doesn't get you excited 7 days a week and twice on Sunday, I don't know what does.
John Rothstein joining us here. Listen, I want to get into the season in a moment and what it's going to look like and what it's going to feel like. Just one last thought about last year, though. If you were to go back to March and the announcement that the 2020 NCAA tournament had been canceled, I mean, John, you are upbeat, you are positive, you are energetic, but how surreal was it not to have March Madness?
It was unfathomable, and you know me pretty well, Jim. You know I'm a big food guy. I felt for 11 months I was working on baking the ultimate cake, and I had mixed it, and I had iced it, and I had sampled the flavor a little bit, and then somebody all of a sudden told me, you can't have dessert.
Man, no doubt, no doubt. So what about from your conversations with college coaches and players, they were working that same cake. From the people you spoke to within, what was the experience like for them?
Well, I think, you know, the ironic thing last season that stood out, maybe more so than past seasons, that, you know, we've obviously had an NCAA tournament, is last year you had a scenario where three of the top eight seeds that were projected for the NCAA tournament were from non-power conferences. Gonzaga was expected to be a one, Dayton was expected to be a one, and San Diego State was probably expected to be a two. You know, Jim, the seasons that we saw at Dayton and San Diego State last season may not be replicated again in the history of their basketball programs. And that's one of the things that I think made the pill a little bit harder to swallow for programs like that, especially as we're starting to see more and more in college basketball, the separation and between the power conferences and the non-power conferences. So I think that was the thing that lasted a little bit longer with me. That and a program like a Baylor that hasn't been to a Final Four under Scott Drew, but has been to an Elite Eight in 2010 and has been to an Elite Eight in 2012, but didn't break through to the Final Four. They don't get an opportunity to punch their ticket. And obviously it felt like Seton Hall with Miles Powell was set up to go to the Final Four for the first time since PJ Carlissimo took the Pirates there in 1989. Remember, Seton Hall was set up to be a high seed in the East region. That would have meant the first two rounds in Albany, and then the, hopefully for their sake, the third and fourth round at Madison Square Garden. But Jim, we'll never know.
You mentioned PJ Carlissimo. I think about Andrew Gaze back in the day, just lighting it up. John Rothstein joining us. John, it's so amazing. Like when you mentioned Gonzaga, if we were to take a step back for a minute, I mean, really think about this. Gonzaga's number one in the preseason AP poll. And on the one hand, the fact that they're a preseason number one is not a surprise because they've been so good, John, for so long. On the other hand, how crazy is it that we're talking about a program that has been built the way it has and that a team from the WCC is the number one team in the country even after losing the conference player of the year?
It's unfathomable. And I personally, you know, put Gonzaga down a couple of pegs because I know just how good Philip Petrušev was last year. He was a force inside. I would have had him as a first team All-American. But lucky for Gonzaga and lucky for Mark Few, they have a guy in Drew Timmy who is tailor-made to inherit the minutes that Philip Petrušev is leaving behind. Timmy last year, Jim, averaged 9.8 points and 5.4 rebounds in just over 20 minutes a game. He will step in seamlessly to the role that was vacated by Petrušev. And Gonzaga, again, very much in the mix for, you know, obviously a high seed in the NCAA tournament. And I think when you look right now at the chemical makeup of this season, at least from 30,000 feet here as we're 9 days away from opening day. You have programs who are non-blue blood programs that are going to be in position to have their best teams in years. Iowa gets back Luca Garza, obviously a first-team All-American and a guy who averaged 24 and 10 a year ago, but they also are going to get healthier because they add their starting point guard back in Jordan Bohannon, who missed last year due to injury. Illinois, with Io DeSumo and Kofi Coburn back, has a chance, in my opinion, to have its best team since the 2005 team that lost to North Carolina in a national championship game. And then there's other teams that we've discussed, like Baylor, like Creighton, that have a chance to have their best teams that they've had in a very, very long time.
We're talking to John Rothstein for a few more moments. We're talking college basketball, the start of the season, about a week and a half out. You know, John, because everything is so weird with the pandemic and time is so weird, lest we forget that Virginia is still technically the defending champs. What about Tony Bennett and Virginia? How do you think they will show up this year?
Well, it's amazing. Tony Bennett last year was, you know, tied for second in the ACC, won 15 ACC games, second behind Florida State. And, Jim, when you look at things right now from an offensive perspective, Virginia averaged its lowest totals and averages in points per game, field goal percentage, and three-point field goal percentage under Tony Bennett, and they still managed to win 15 ACC games. Now, what's the remedy for a bad offensive team? Great shooting. And that's why if there's one name right now for people from the periphery to put in bold print when it comes to Virginia, it's Sam Hauser. The transfer from Marquette is bigger and stronger than he was 2 years ago when he played for the Golden Eagles. And think about this from a shooting perspective. Sam Hauser has played 3 years of college basketball. He's never shot less than 40% from three, and he's never made less than 63 three-point shots in the season. For a team that struggled to score, Jim, that sounds like a pretty good remedy.
I'll say so. He's a college basketball insider for CBS. He is the host of the College Hoops Today podcast. He is a friend of the program and fired up as always. John Rothstein, my guest. John, great to have you back. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jim. Stay safe, my friend.
Ross Tucker came on and nailed his hit like he always does. He said the Bills Cards game was the game of the year and mentioned that Hail Mary was the play of the year and the best Hail Mary he's ever seen. So let's get into that, because that was the game of the weekend. And then in the end, it turned out to be the game of the year. But do not take my word for it. Don't even take Ross's word for it. You know whose word you should take for it? Blake Shelton. He tweeted, quote, "My God, Arizona, what a game. Congrats. I died, came back to life, bleeped my pants, and hyperextended my scrotum, all in 30 seconds. End of tweet. Yeah, thanks, Blake. Thanks for that, brah. Thank you very much for that mental picture. Hope you were able to ice up. Hope you're able to ice your junk. Hey, he's right, though, right? If a football game was going to make you die, come back to life, crap yourself, and hyperextend your scrotum, it probably had to be that game, because that game had everything. It had Josh Allen turning into a wide receiver early on.
The snap, and they give it to McKenzie. He wants to throw, throws it back to Josh, who makes the catch at the 10. Allen at the 5, diving into the end zone, touchdown. Josh Allen catches a touchdown pass. He caught a touchdown pass. Unbelievable.
The only thing missing was him throwing it to himself. If anybody could, Kyler Murray could. Kyler Murray continued to be the most electric guy in the entire game when he showed it with this run.
Snap to Murray, and he's going to keep it off the left side. He's at the 10, at the 5. He's in again! Kyler Murray into double figures with rushing touchdowns on the season. Some more Murray magic.
Here he comes to save the day. The mighty Kyler Murray.
Cards Radio. And then it had all the action. All the action in the final minute of the fourth quarter. Buffalo down by 3. Josh Allen doing work. Cole Beasley making ridiculous catches.
From the gun. Allen throws it. Oh, what a grab! Cole Beasley!
He climbs up one hand, brings it in, and gets his feet down after the push by Byron Murphy.
Right? Then Allen comes back. He moves the Bills down into field goal range to tie the game, but he wanted more. and he got it on this play.
The snap. Allen looks to his left. Fires left side. In going to the end zone. Stephon Diggs makes the catch. Touchdown, Buffalo. Touchdown, Stephon Diggs.
Wow, Steph Diggs.
And at that point, there's not that much time left on the clock. Steph Diggs, if you need him. That was an absolutely perfect ball and an absolutely perfect catch. And that's not Diggs beating some scrub. He beat Patrick Peterson on that play. And that's if you can even call that beating Peterson, because I'm not sure what more Peterson could have done. That was damn good coverage. But Allen and Diggs still beat it. That trade for Diggs is looking better and better by the game, especially with him leading the league in receptions and receiving yardage, and then coming up with moments like that with 34 seconds left. 34 seconds left. That's not that much time on the clock.
The clock.
That pass from Allen to Diggs was perfection. The Bills win. They move to 8-2. It's an incredible moment for the Bills Mafia. Their team is rolling, and it's time to start thinking about postseason seeding. Run out the 34 seconds, because that, again, is not much time on the clock. Arizona gets the ball at the 25. They pick up 14 yards on their first down. They've got to burn their second timeout. They pick up 9 on the next play. They have to use their final timeout. Then a short pass to Larry Fitzgerald, who's able to get out of bounds. But the play did use up 10 seconds. That's a lot of clock. Then there are 11 seconds are left. Arizona's got the ball in the Arizona 43. Roll it and do it, knowing that Blake Shelton's scrotum is about to get hyperextended.
Murray back to throw, flushed out, rolling left in trouble, slips a tackle, got to launch it. He does. Left side, into the end zone, jump ball, and it is. Is it caught? Is it caught? Oh, my goodness, it's caught. DeAndre Hopkins caught it. He caught it for a touchdown with 1 second left. I can't believe it. You've got to be joking me. Hopkins reaches up with three defenders around him and pulls it in. And the Cardinals lead it 32-30 with a second left.
You can't cover Nuke. You're not going to be able to cover him. Throw the ball up.
Like, I don't know how many times I've seen that. Probably 20. I still cannot believe what I'm seeing. That ball was thrown into triple coverage. There were three Bills players right there with DeAndre Hopkins, and it still was not enough. There are three guys right there. Two of them are Pro Bowlers. And Hop is still the guy who somehow came down with that ball. The only guy who could have stopped DeAndre Hopkins from making that catch was Bill O'Brien. Hail! Bill O'Brien probably suffered his own hyperextended scrote watching that play. Or worse, if there is anything worse than a hyperextended scrote. But seriously, remember when B.O.B. traded DeAndre Hopkins? That trade was one of the dumbest deals in the history of the NFL at that time, and it looks 10 times worse right now. As Kyler Murray tweeted right after the game, "Sheed, hop down there somewhere." And Hopkins replied, quote, "Never panic." See, that's the thing. And Ross Tucker laid this out, but I want to reiterate this. That was not some fluky play. That was not like the ball bounced around, hit a bunch of guys, and just landed in Nuke's hands when he was lying on his back. That was anything but that. This guy just went up and he got it above three other really good players. He just went up and single-handedly beat three other alphas. Just ripped the ball from three other grown-ass men with the game on the line. He was asked afterwards, "Nuke, how in fact did you do that?"
It was on three people. Yeah, it was, you know, they were in position. It was just a better catch by I.
Man, what a great quote. I love that so much. Quote, "It was on three people. They were in position. It was just a better catch by I." That was just a better catch by I. Or to put it another way, Hopkins tapped the top of his head in the postgame.
You know, in basketball terminology, that's what they call this. You know, when somebody get dunked on.
That was just a better take by I. Man, that's the truth. The painful truth. The Bills secondary just got dunked on by Hopkins. Hopkins just dunked on them. Just dunked on the entire up-and-coming shiny city that is Buffalo. Dunked on B.O.B. again. Like, every time this guy makes a huge play for the rest of his career, Bob's name is going to come up. But as great as that catch was, and it was incredible, do not sleep on the fact that somebody had to get that ball to that spot at that time. Because Kyler Murray was totally nuts on that play as well. Run that back one more time.
The snap. Murray pressured. Bills rush four. Murray's in trouble. Gets away from it. Rolls to his left. Fires it downfield. Puts it up for grabs. And it is
caught.
Caught for a touchdown. Unbelievable. Caught by DeAndre Hopkins, surrounded by a couple of Bills defenders. He went up and brought it down. Unbelievable. Incredible. 1 second left on the clock.
Obviously, Bills radio.
The clock.
He scrambles out. He lets it fly. That ball was caught.
Caught.
How many other quarterbacks, though, can make that play? How many other quarterbacks can keep that play alive, show that kind of escapability, and then throw that kind of a ball against his body that far to that exact spot with the game on the line? Name another guy who can do that right now. And here's something else that's amazing. Cliff and Kyler as a combo. It seems like a no-brainer right now. It seems like a no-brainer now that they're tied for first in the NFC West in their second season together, but it was anything but a no-brainer when Steve Keim and the Cardinals did that. That was ballsy as hell at the time, and it's paying off in a big way right now. What an enormous swing by Keim and the Cards, and one of the smartest things ever. Nobody thinks that now, per se, but at the time, man, that was a big, big, ballsy swing. Now somebody should go check on Blake Shelton and his hyperextended scrot and hit him with a new pair of pants. Because he also said that in that moment, he apparently crapped himself.
If any one of you doesn't respect me or what I'm doing or what I've been doing for the last 3 months since it's been announced, going against a guy like this, you'd have a big dump in your pants.
I love that we got some context finally for that quote.
You'd have a big dump in your pants.
In a hypoextended scrotum.
It was just a better catch by I.
It was a better catch by I. One of the best catches by I ever.
It was just a better catch by I.
Let's check out some reaction. Stucknut's in. Quote, isn't Blake Shelton a fat guy, according to Liz in Fall City?
Who was the myopic panel voting on this award? Were they drunk or only handed blurry pictures of Blake? The guy is a fat Ewok disguised as a country hick who allegedly has talent. And with this guy being the sexiest man alive, I seriously fear that clones like Bodie and Pearland are going to feel like they have hope in the looks department.
Good night now!